Hello and welcome to PMI's podcast, Leading for Business Excellence. I'm Susanna Clark, and in this episode, I'm joined by Suraj Patel, Director of Operational Strategy for Capital One. Suraj started his career as an IT graduate for E.ON. Working with a mentor, a couple of years into his career, he saw an opportunity for change and diversified into continuous improvement and operational excellence. With his current role at Capital One in operational strategy, you can imagine that I was really interested to hear him talk about the link between operational excellence and operational strategy and how these two work together to drive the results for the organization. You're not going to be surprised that, of course, we talk about the challenges that people are aware of the banking industry and responsibility to customers. So it's great to hear Suraj talk about what they are doing within Capital One, the importance of banking being for good to enable people to manage their loans and credit so that they can use finance to enhance their lives and well-being and not to be a burden that they are unable to cope with. So do enjoy this episode with Suraj Patel. And I do look forward to hearing any feedback that you'd like to share with me. You can always get in touch via team@pmi.co.uk. Hi, Suraj. Great to have you with us today. Thank you so much for joining me in our Leading for Business Excellence podcast. I wondered if you could just give us a brief introduction for our listeners, just a little bit about who you are and maybe a short summary of your career.
Yeah, absolutely. So my name's Suraj Patel. I currently am the Director of Operational Strategy at Capital One, but it's been quite a windy road, I guess, over my career to get to this stage. I actually started off as an IT graduate at E.ON Energy, based out of the UK to start with, and studied computer science at university. I was really drawn in at the time. I think Facebook was just coming onto the scene. It was quite big. The whole working in technology was really appealing. So I thought that was the way forward for me and my career. And it seemed to be a bit of a boom industry at the time. So I followed that path and started on E.ON's tech grad scheme and saw me work out in multiple countries, not only in the UK. I spent some time in the Czech Republic and Germany as well, and with such a big company. I think quite quickly after the grad scheme, realized that the tech, or at least tech at E.ON, wasn't like my aspirations and didn't quite fit my skill set and didn't quite fit my personality type. And I had a really good mentor at the time, and he helped me like work on my what were really my strengths, and I was really analytical, and therefore a natural progression for me was more into the consultancy side. It took me to work in E.ON in-house consultancy, like an in-house consultancy function for E.ON, where I spent a number of years on lean operational excellence programs across the world, which was really, really exciting. And then travel kind of got a bit tedious after several years of being away from home. And a really cool opportunity to do similar at Capital One came knocking. And that was amazing because Capital One, with a huge global presence again, but has quite a small footprint in the UK, meant that I could travel less, spend more time with my family, start a family. And therefore, I moved over to Capital One to do a similar role, which then over the years kind of morphed as they naturally do internally to lead a strategy team.
I mean, I think that that story of starting in one thing, let's say you were an IT graduate, that's the path you started on. What I find interesting, you know, I've got a couple of children, they're in their 20s, an awful lot of their friends seem to be concerned perhaps that once you start in something, you have to keep going in that one thing. And I'm always keen to say, no, loads of options. Actually, just take the opportunity to see how this goes. And then maybe you can make another decision later on.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I never knew what I wanted to do growing up. I think it flipped and flopped with the wind. Like it was a fighter jet pilot. It was a police officer. it was anything exciting, anything that wasn't business related, to be honest. But absolutely, that's true. I think getting into a big enough company that allows you to take enough leaps is the trajectory. And I think most companies nowadays recognize when you've got good talent, how to you know, hone that talent and how to nurture it is exactly the beneficial for them and beneficial for your own career development. Those like linear career trajectories rarely exist now.
And interesting that you had a mentor as well, and a mentor who was interested in retaining and growing your talent. You know, that's a real asset to have, isn't it? For someone who hasn't got a mentor, what would you advise in that way?
Yeah, I mean, my mentor was really into strengths-based stuff. And like, I was really fortunate to have somebody that kind of was backing my corner, for want of a better word. Sometimes mentorship is around just sound advice. I think as you take that advice, it's always nice to then have a senior leader that recognizes something in you and is willing to take a bit of a bet on you. I think for someone that doesn't have a mentor, it isn't about just going out and getting one. It's about finding out what you want from that mentor, making sure that relationship's set up for success. And it's got to be a two-way street as well. I think mentorship is never just a, hey, I need to be affiliated to you, for want of a better word, because you being affiliated to your name could land me a bigger job.
And out of interest, have you now become a mentor for anyone?
Yeah, I mentor several different people, both internal and external to Capital One. And mentorship, I think for me, is around, hasn't got to be an enduring relationship. It can be a couple of sessions. It can be multiple years. I still mentor people that I used to work with and used to manage in previous companies, and vice versa. I still have some of my mentors I still reach out to when I don't know what to do. He used to mentor me and we still keep in touch.
I love that whole kind of that evolving and the network side of that. You know, you've got mentors who you go to, you mentor others, and it's that cycle of support, networking, having an outside view, I think as a leader as well, is just absolutely key. There should be no assumption that every leader knows everything that they need to do or have to do, should there?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Like if your leader knows the answer, then he's kind of a dictator, isn't he? Like, or she is telling you what to do. And hopefully a good leader coaches you, right? Like I always tell my team right now, which is, if I tell you the answer, you're just implementers of my vision. It's not empowering, it's not exciting, and ultimately it's quite limiting.
So I was interested when, you know, we first met, talking about your shift really from lean operational excellence into strategy and how you see those two connecting in terms of leadership and in terms of organizational success.
Lean seems to be a methodology that always gets tarnished or branded with this cost-saving umbrella over it. So people tend to roll it out to go when a cost saving is needed in the company. So typically lean programs, and I've been guilty of setting them up in companies that need to save money. Therefore, it's all about efficiency. That's the big word that comes in when you talk about lean. It's like, how do we just make things cheaper and faster? Go and do it. And that's great. Lean programs really work really well because there's a strong call to action. There's a real strong call to action, which is this company is struggling financially. We need to find efficiencies to save us some money. And you know, people have a clear direction to go after and they see the success and the benefits of working in this way of identifying waste, removing it, and seeing the results come off the end of the production line. Brilliant. Like great, works in that environment. Lean then kind of fizzles out when that cost stretch goes away and people get a bit lost to go, right, I'm still doing efficiency, but it doesn't really get it over the line, or the resources that I need to unlock this saving aren't then being afforded to me because they're going on something else. And then I found, like in my own career as well, situations where I'm going, hey, there's a huge opportunity to improve something here for the customer, or a huge opportunity here to save some money for us, but we're not capitalizing on it. And I can't get the tech resource, for example, to pivot onto it. And it's because the improvement didn't align to the business direction at that time. And that's where I feel like lean programs in the past have got lost, because they've kind of been rinsed and repeated for short wins. And so like moving into the strategy team, I really wanted to help set the direction of where the company's going and where the business needs to go. And then people know where the optimizations are needed, because they're not always needed in cost. Sometimes they're needed in customer outcomes. Sometimes they're needed in better customer experience. Sometimes they're needed in just regulatory changes that need implementing. And there's a multitude of different ways you could implement that lean toolkit. It's just trying to figure out and align what the vision is to then what do I need to do to fulfill that vision.
I know what you mean by fizzle out, because when we talk to people about how do I decide what problem I'm going to work on for my Lean Six Sigma project, etc., we always say to them, well, what are the priorities of the organization? Because if they are not linked to the priorities of the organization, you're going to struggle to get sponsorship. You're going to struggle to get the time available to work on it. It's got to bother people, hasn't it?
Exactly. And people and organizations are full of amazing ideas. And it's the conversion of those ideas into like where the rubber hits the road. That's what great lean professionals in my experience are able to do, is understand how do I take a problem and align it to a business need, ultimately a salesman. And that's ultimately what you need to then get the resources you need to unlock that win. And those lean professionals I've found in the past that could really communicate a storyline will get the resources they need and will be able to solve the big problems, because those problems are the need of the business at that point in time.
So in the strategy role that you now find yourself in, can you tell me a bit about how you cascade that strategy and help the people in the organization convert that so that they understand what they need to do?
Yeah, and so we have this overall mission, strategic direction from the top of the UK business, which is to change banking for good. Really aspirational, amazing philosophy behind it. But actually for me, if I was on the ground, it's hard to engage with, to go, well, what does that need of me to do that, to get into like such an aspirational vision? And so a lot of the work that me and the team do is trying to understand what are the big blockers that are stopping us from achieving that from a global picture, and then break that down into smaller chunks, more manageable elements of it. So like I create little target conditions of, by the end of this year or by the end of 2 years, here's where we want to be. And if we get to that state in 2 years, we're a bit closer to the overall vision, but you've kind of got a slight direction and a bit of a breakdown on which way to go to. The other bit on target conditions is to help through creating metrics that allow them to say, hey, here's roughly where we need to get to for what good looks like. And we can measure against something quite short term rather than this long term vision, because a lot changes. And particularly now in the world we live in, the world we live in sounds really, really grand, right? But we've come a long way in 3 years. Like we've had the global pandemic, which totally reshifted everyone's baseline on what good business performance looks like and what the customer needs. And companies went into just basic survival mode. Like, how do I keep the lights on? And we thought coming out of this, it would be brilliant, high growth rates, everyone's spending again. You've had a lot of money pepped up in the economy that's waiting to be spent. It started off great. And now you've got a global conflict coming in, which again causes a lot of uncertainty. You've got hyperinflation starting to kick in, which again causes a lot of uncertainty, particularly in my industry where we're lending money. You know, energy prices are going up. The cost of living for people is being squeezed. And so the goal is constantly shifting on what success looks like for a business on probably a quicker cycle than I've ever seen it before. You know, the external environment is so unstable that you're going to have to adapt really quickly.
So you were just saying about that, you know, adjusting this it quicker on faster cycles. So how do you do that? What's the kind of process, if you like, I suppose, that you operate to review, understand, and therefore adapt to whatever the needs may be of those changes you're seeing?
Yeah, I'd love to sit here and go, we've got it all figured out. And there's this like wonderful system we have in place that allows us to do that. Ultimately, we create a lot of guardrails of where we feel we can operate within. And those guardrails kind of tell us, are we on course or not? And if we're approaching some of those guardrails, that's the key trigger to go, hey, we need to do something different on that. And that's probably the mechanism we use to try and help us identify, should we take a different strategy here?
And you said that that's happening faster. So what does fast mean? Because it's not yearly, presumably, or is it faster than that?
No, it's a lot sooner. So I think, sometimes you want to go into this huge phase of growth, for example, where you go, we've had a period of difficult financial conditions where we've not lent as much money in our case. But now we want to lend money to the market. But again, now the market's not stable because you've got the cost of living squeeze or you've got a war going on. It makes it, again, the outlook of what's going to happen in the future less certain. The more uncertain you have, the more risk happens in your strategy. So you end up creating lots of more monitoring, lots of more waypoints to help understand when is the optimum time to do something different. It's the same in our service, and where I work a lot more on the services side, which is the needs of the customers change drastically through these periods of where you've got the pandemic hitting. You had a lot of customers who just weren't too sure what was happening with their jobs. The needs of our customer service agents were vastly different there, and making sure we've got good solutions for them, but also turning into a bit of coaching for those people and a bit of an agony aunt to help them through some quite tough times, through to now where people are struggling to heat their homes. Again, it's a different take on it, but it's a different mix of people struggling, and the skills of those agents that we need to support those customers are beyond just servicing, changing of addresses or issuing new cards. It's really trying to help them understand their financial situation and what's affordable for them.
Yes, because there's an interesting sense of responsibility there, isn't there? Which, the banking industry hasn't necessarily always come out well in that regard. And I know when we first talked around this, you were quite clear about the importance of making your customers successful.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how you need to go about doing that.
It's a market we're really proud to work in, which is helping people succeed with credit. We lend predominantly to customers that are either new to finance or have struggled with finance in the past. And having access to credit is so important to every single person, be that from buying a new car through to just affording to feed your family that week. People need credit for different scenarios. And so for us, like helping customers that have struggled in the past get on track with their credit really is, it feels like quite philanthropic, like we're doing something for the greater good. But in reality, we're doing something that is hopefully like common decency, which is how can we help people basically get their life back on track? Like credit, someone like you or I, we might take for granted access to it as well. But for others, credit is really hard to come by and limits a lot of opportunities for them. So the company philosophy is very much built on like, how do we help these people not only get access to credit, but succeed with that credit?
And that's a lot of psychology going on here. So there's a lot of psychology built into the understanding of the external world, the understanding of the customer by yourself in strategy, and then obviously the agreement with the leadership team that this is our strategy, this is what we're focused on. And then there has to be this cascade down to your frontline agents who need that training to be able to carry out both the strategy, but be competent from a psychology perspective to be able to work with customers.
Yeah, I mean, there is an army of people at Capital One that either go out and understand what the market's doing, understand what the economy is doing, understand what customer needs are doing, and an army of people that translate that into what we're going to do, and another army of people that go and translate into that, how can our frontline agents then deliver that to the customers, deliver the experiences we want them to have to the customer.
And so that's about kind of going down, isn't it? We're going out, we're looking, we're agreeing with the leadership team, we're cascading it down to people who will then enable the frontline, give the customer experience. So how do you know, as leaders in Capital One, how do you know that you're achieving the goals? How do you know that the customers are feeling the benefit of your strategy and approach?
Yes, we have a good defined metric suite, as most leaderships would have, which tells us where are the bits that we really can't fail on. And we monitor performance against that on a even hourly basis of like, where is it? It just simply can't go wrong. Versus like, how are those experiences then being live through. So you've got some of the basic hygiene stuff, like, are we answering the phones within a certain period of time? How many customers are waiting? Through to some of the experiential side of it, like NPS, to say, well, did they have a good experience when they got through to us? Did they get the answer they needed? For some of the struggling customers, we don't only look at the individual phone call, but we look at what happened to that customer in their life cycle after that. Did they go on to succeed, or did they not go on to succeed and have to fall back into needing financial support?
So you're really looking at that whole customer journey end to end. That's really interesting as well, isn't it? Not just we have a result. We've managed to arrange credit for somebody, but what exactly their longer journey with you is.
Exactly. And like, it spans multiple departments of Capital One as well, beyond operations, to make that happen.
When you were giving your introduction, obviously you talked about the fact that you'd had the opportunity originally to work in Czech Republic, in Germany, and obviously you were also working in a very different industry, in the utilities industry. What's your experience of both the cultural differences that you see between sectors and also even between, you know, countries?
Between sectors, to start with, the utilities industry is a really low margin game. And therefore, it was all around, like, how do we have really efficient interactions in the servicing side that supports customers? But the focus very much was on the bottom line. Margins are really tight. There isn't much room for error. And therefore, the focus was on, like, how do we just not carry a lot of weight? Between countries as well, that was interesting because the UK was a nationalized energy industry, became privatized, and that privatization, the nationalization history doesn't go away overnight. You carry a lot of fat into the privatization, and there was a lot of overheads that we still maintained from the previous years. Not, you know, it was privatized well before I joined the company, and the industry was privatized well before I even started thinking about my careers, but the legacy still lived on 20 years on. And so a lot of the challenges were around, you know, moving away from that mindset of there is an unlimited budget here, which is the government owners, to actually we have shareholders that we need to appease. Whereas in the financial service industry, the focus is more around customers and how the outcomes of the products we lend to customers land. Both industries heavily regulated, but regulated on different aspects. And the financial services industry is more around how can we make sure customers are getting the right outcomes when it comes to lending practices, and trying to change, I guess, the image that you alluded to earlier on around credit companies and becoming like vultures. Ultimately, how do we change that mindset? It's a negative one that I can hand on heart say isn't true about my firm. But equally, energy companies have had a bad rub of the green when it comes to image and perception as well, more recently now with some of the pricing that's going on, but especially in the past as well. Like, energy companies have been seen as money printing machines, which necessarily wasn't true.
So how do you see those cultural differences and the market differences that you're describing affecting the people who are working in those organizations? And in particular, I'm interested, I suppose, in the leadership elements of that, in terms of what the leadership responsibilities, how they manifest themselves in those different types of organization.
Yeah, I found leadership to be a bit more directive in the energy industry. It was a bit more blunter. A blunter tool that leadership was, which was a bit more command and control and kind of here's where we need to get to. Go get there. There was a clear purpose, which was, as I said, low margin. Everyone understood the rules of the game, which was how do we just strip out waste from all of this stuff and make this stuff really lean, for want of a better word. And you were held to account on that. And there was a clear consequence of getting it wrong on the bottom line. I think then the leadership in the financial services sector is a bit more guided in terms of you're a lot more autonomy to go and explore, go and innovate, go and try new things, and a lot more room for error when it comes to the financial side. Obviously, a lot less room for error when it comes to the customer side, where as genuine customers that where we get it wrong have big ramifications on their life and their lifestyle. Whereas on energy, there isn't much you could get wrong for a customer. Seldom do you cut a customer off from electricity and gas in the United Kingdom. So the fall was big for a customer between the two industries. You cut them off from credit, they might not be able to feed their family. Whereas not getting it right on a service interaction on an energy company means a bit of disruption for them to call back in, but they're not being cut off from the bill. So there's pros and cons to both worlds.
So I like the idea of the, you know, you describe the go see, go innovate. I'm interested as well in the fact that you obviously come from an IT background yourself. How have you found the use of technology in terms of helping your organization, the organizations you've worked with, to succeed, to improve the business processes? What's your experience of that?
Yeah, I'm like on the extreme end, or I kind of have this thing, which is if you've had to call us up, we've already let you down. So unless you're calling up for a bigger credit line, there isn't much we offer on the phone that isn't something that you should be able to do through a digital platform. The same in the energy industry. If you're calling up, something's gone wrong for you to call up. You're not calling an energy company up to have a nice chat. Right. And so I think technology plays a big role in terms of how do we help people to service those things where it goes wrong themselves. Moreover, how do we just stop those things going wrong in the first place? Which is the win, the ultimate win. And the needs of customers, and particularly like my generation of customers, is that like we hate talking to people. Like I hate talking to people. I hate using the phone.
Welcome to the podcast.
I know. Who would have thought that picking up the phone fills me with dread alone, like, you know, even ordering a takeaway. Why phone a restaurant when you can use Deliveroo or Uber Eats? And that's where technology really needs to play a part and catch up, which is service interactions are more complicated, as I alluded to earlier on in the podcast. Customers have difficult financial needs, and sometimes they're embarrassed about talking about them over the phone. But technology acts as a bit of a screening layer that allows you to be open and honest about your financial situation without feeling you're judged by another human who's sat on the other end. I think we've got to figure out how to use technology to help, like, have those deep and difficult conversations and allow people to open up in a different way.
Yes. I heard, and in talking to actually, not in your sector, but in other sectors, that one of the things that changed in the course of the pandemic was actually not your generation, but the older generation became more technology savvy because they had to be, both in terms of communicating with their family, to start off with, the ability to just use simple technology on their phones to be able to do video calls, to stay in touch, etc. Is that something that you've found within Capital One, that actually people have taken to more comfortably now to the use of digital technology?
Absolutely. Like the thought of what a QR code even was, let alone like how to access what the QR code was saying, was alien, right? Before the pandemic, everyone knows what a QR code is now. And the same with using our mobile app or our web servicing platform, customers were encouraged to utilize that platform, like, and became more natural to them as a way of engaging with us over the pandemic. A lot of people naturally went to the app or the web over the pandemic to service their accounts, because their assumption was most call centers are actually struggling over that period and will have long wait times. Like, quite fortunately, actually, we had a really strong performance cycle over the pandemic window, and like our suppliers were really great in helping us service our customers and keep service levels strong. But customers just assumed we were going to be busy and so went onto the digital platforms, which is great. And we've seen that stick through. The stickiness is still there and people still are continuing to service themselves over the digital platforms.
And your strategy to continuously innovate those platforms, you know, what sort of methods, approaches do you have for thinking about what might be different, thinking about how you could improve the customer experience?
Yeah, one of the big bits for us at the moment that we're contending with is security for financial services. The security of a customer's account is primary. And we just had a big new regulation go in, Payment Services Directive 2, strong customer authentication go in, which is something quite complex for a customer because it requires two factors of authentication for you to do anything, such as change your address. You know, you've got to prove who you are, both physically through something that you are or something that you own, as well as something you know. You know, the days of tell me your date of birth and, you know, what your mother's maiden name are long gone. Fraudsters are well on top of that. And so a lot of the customer friction element of our service inside and strategy I want to implement is around how do I eliminate some of that friction that I by now had to put into those calls where customers find difficult, you know, like having a one-time passcode as a text message, for example, is something that I can use to say, hey, I can prove it's you on the other end because you're the only person who that passcode could possibly go to. But from a seamless customer experience point of view, it feels a bit clunky. And so our strategies will continue to evolve around how do we make sure we're offering secure servicing, protecting customers from fraud, but also minimizing the friction it takes to get them there. And that's going to be a big focus for us for the next couple of years, at least, is to continue to innovate in that area.
I like that word, customer friction. I have to say, felt it a couple of times myself. Not with you. I hasten to add.
Yeah, it's not a great thing, friction, especially like when you're requiring servicing. As I said at the start, like you're only calling somebody because something's gone wrong. So any additional friction just gets you more and more wound up. Absolutely. It's not helping.
No. So throughout your career that you've had so far, both you know, starting as an IT grad through to where you are today, who would you say or what has been a significant influence on you and your leadership style today?
I think I've been really lucky over my career to work with some amazing leaders. Been fortunate to work with people that have been really open and engaging and wanting to try different things. I think there's a couple that stand out for me. One is my old mentor I spoke about earlier in the podcast, Darren Cornish. He had this magnetism of energy that like would suck you in but also give you so much energy in return. He was a big giver of energy, and one bit he taught me really early on in my career was about this strengths finder. And he really, really challenged me on what are my strengths. And I came to this conclusion that, hey, why am I always in this model of me trying to work on my development areas to make me an average Joe? Why would I not just work on my strengths and hopefully try and like mitigate my weaknesses or my development areas so it doesn't expose me? But I'm always in situations where my strengths are put in front of me, and therefore I'm always on the front foot. I'm always putting myself in my best light. And I think that really helped my career a lot, which is finding jobs that do what I'm naturally good at, rather than trying to find jobs where I'm okay in some things, I'd struggle in a few others, and I just become average. I think he's definitely one. And another person is a lady called Lisa Norcross. And I was so lucky to work with Lisa, who was our SVP for operational excellence at E.ON. I got to work with Lisa to see firsthand her build a global lean program. The bit I thought was incredibly valuable and I do take on today in my career is the diversity, inclusion and belonging element that she brought along. We had a team that was built up from people all over the world, from different continents, from different countries, all spoke different languages. She had to influence these programs into countries that, you know, she wasn't a first language speaker in, very male-dominated boards across multiple countries as well, and that she had to work her way into. And I found her like vision of how she created something from nothing really inspiring. But again, the drive as well to implement that vision, really exciting. And, you know, gave me a lot of opportunities to go out and try and set up different programs in different countries as well. So I do owe a lot to her. And she taught me a lot about lean as well.
Going back to your point on strengths, I did a lot of training or being trained a lot and studying on coaching. And I went on a strengths coaching program. And that for me was revolutionary. I completely agree with you. The switch from why am I constantly trying to improve this stuff that personally doesn't inspire me particularly and I'm not particularly good at, when really I should focus on what my strengths are. And then coaching others in that way and seeing them get rid of the shackles of trying to improve things that they don't like and that they're not good at, and actually focusing on things that are much more fun and positive because it gives them energy. I think it's an amazing tool to look at strengths coaching. Really, really important.
And organizations need to be really mature to like take that on board. I feel like the traditional job families that we have kind of pigeonhole us into, here's what a certain person looks like. If I take a lean professional, for example, you'd assume they have to be really good at analytical skills, but you've got to then find a great analyst who's good at communication also to unlock the analytical element of it. And so like, how do we build teams that are around different strengths that people can bring to that team? How do we build virtual teams so people can work with different skilled people on different bases? And so you've got the right skills for the right problem. That's a really mature organization will allow that element of flex.
And the two points that you made about the differences, the strengths leader and Lisa, who is more around diversity and inclusion, and then what you've just described about that range of skills, of course, those two actually come together into one, don't they? Because it's diversity at all levels.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we can achieve a lot more if we unshackle ourselves from like some of the stereotypes that we end up putting ourselves in. I don't think anyone puts you in certain boxes. You just end up taking a role on from somebody that had done it before, and you naturally just slip into their shoes, don't you? And you do it how they do it. And I think as a leader, I try and encourage people to say, well, that's how they did it. That's not how you could do it.
Through the conversation about the role that you're in now and the strategy of Capital One, we talked a lot about customer service. I'm interested in what your best ever customer service experience has been.
Good question. It's nothing actually that exciting. I think it's, but that's, I think, what good customer service is, right? I think you get what you pay for sometimes when I think about customer service. And if I think about, I don't know, I've paid for a first class flight, I'm going to expect amazing service and I'm going to expect to be wowed. And I'll probably speak lyrical or wax lyrical about that brand because like it was an amazing experience, but I forget I've paid through the roof for that. Like I think people quickly forget that. I love the customer experiences where I just wasn't expecting such simplicity from such a transactional element. I mean, a great example for that is I ordered an adapter only a month or so back for my MacBook, a little adapter that now they don't put USB ports on these computers. I needed to have, and randomly a cat carrier turned up in the post. And I was thinking, I've got a cat, but I definitely didn't order this. So he quite seamlessly like tagged it on Amazon, said, hey, didn't order this. It was meant to be this. And within seconds, the agent was like, absolutely not a problem. We'll send you one out. Exactly on that same day, the right product turns up. And so they went from a problem to no problem within the space of a day for a remote company. I thought was actually incredible. Now, Amazon, absolutely a huge player, but it was an item that was less than £10. Mm. I was left with a cat carrier, which I actually do still use for free.
But it was lucky you had the cat.
Yeah, lucky I did have the cat. But the speed of which they resolved that and the, I guess, the lack of questioning and the trust they had in me that, hey, what I was saying was true, like I found really great. I found that they weren't going to challenge me on like, are you sure? Are you trying to scam me? Yeah, they were straight into customer mode, which is, hey, let me just get this thing out to you as soon as possible and we'll figure out anything else we need to after the event.
Yes. It's interesting. I like that your example, the words you use there, that they had trust in you, because I think it creates such a different relationship, doesn't it? When you have this sense that whoever the supplier or provider is, that they trust you as a customer rather than imagining that you're just trying to take the mick, because goodness knows most people actually are there to be trusted.
Absolutely. And it's a mindset I went into the chat with, which is like, how am I going to prove that this thing turned up without, you know, just taking a photo or something? And so, yeah, I went in with a, like, here's some evidence and here's how I can prove it. But actually, I didn't even need any of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that trust therefore engenders further loyalty, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And the simplicity of the whole experience, that user experience, the design was seamless and took minutes rather than hours. Again, like one of the bits I hate on phone calls is having to take time for stuff to get done. It was really seamless, a couple of clicks. And you know, the Amazon network is renowned for quick delivery, same day now. So that always helps.
Yes. It's been really fascinating hearing all of your stories. And I really appreciate particularly your customer focus. And that sense really comes through. You've talked a lot about leadership and those people who've been great leaders for you. I'm interested if at some point in the future there was a possibility to be reincarnated and you could come back as any leader, who would you come back as and why?
What a difficult question to answer. So many I'd come back, and for so many different reasons as well. The one that stands out for me, I probably wouldn't come back as him himself. I'd come back as one of his employees just so I can watch the man in action. I'd come back as one of Elon Musk's employees. I find his philosophy absolutely fascinating in terms of how he goes about taking something so difficult and making it accessible for the everyday person. You've seen it with Tesla and the electric car, and how many years did big car giants like spend trying to figure out the next evolution of petrol? And then, you know, Tesla, this startup, came up from nowhere and has dominated the market. And the prices are so low that it's accessible for all. But moreover, like the vision of SpaceX, the one that doesn't get talked about enough, he is on a mission to make travel to Mars accessible for all people, not only travel to outer space, to the moon, to Mars. And he's taken on some huge, huge challenges. I think, you know, one of the big ones was launching the Dragon rocket up to the International Space Station and actually now getting NASA's space program back on track, with NASA couldn't have afforded to carry on the space program. They were losing billions through it. And he's found a way of making spaceflight commercially affordable for NASA now. So they've outsourced an American space program to a private company. You know, and how incredible is that? That, you know, in the entire history of human race, like three countries went to outer space. You had the US, China, and Russia. And now you've got a private company, the fourth ones, to do that, and to made it really cheap, really reusable. And so, you know, something that big countries couldn't have done, like the mice of NASA couldn't have made space travel cheap, yet he's somehow made it commercially viable. And the bit that excites me, right, is imagine we pointed him at the NHS. I always hear the NHS is too big a monster to turn around and make efficient. And I think, hey, if you can change the space program to make it more efficient, I'm pretty sure we can do something about the NHS.
And something about harnessing that it sounds trite. I was about to say out of the box thinking, and then I think, oh my God, everyone says that. And so I don't mean it, you know, I mean it really seriously, the innovation, the creativity, the thinking way beyond what anyone might consider as normal or possible. That's really, you know, that generates my curiosity.
Yeah, absolutely. And the willingness to take controlled risk. I think I obviously work in an environment where risk is like the business we do. But the parallels from like NASA to SpaceX are NASA's approach is let's like write it down and test it 100 times before we launch. So the confidence degree is high, but the time on the ideation pad is long. Whereas the SpaceX approach was, hey, we're going to crash a few rockets. It's going to be fine, but we're going to continue to learn with each crash. So when we do finally put people in this thing, we'd have the utmost confidence it's going to be safe.
People within PMI would be talking about PDSA at this point. They'd be saying that is that PDSA cycle, you know, learn, you know, fail fast, learn quickly, go again and develop what you know, your ideas. Suresh, thank you so much. Honestly, it's been so interesting talking to you. I'm very encouraged by the conversation we've had about the focus on the customer, particularly in the financial services sector, and particularly at a time like now. As you rightly say, it's a tough world out there with many factors that are causing financial concern for people. And I think it's really important to hear that financial services are recognising that, Capital One is recognising that, and that you're working towards ensuring that your customers are safe with you. But also interesting to hear about your, you know, your past and how that connection with the lean operational excellence feeds into the work that you do with strategy today. Really, really interesting.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on today.
You're very, very welcome. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining me in this episode with Suresh Patel. I do hope you enjoyed it. If you'd like to know more about leadership, please do go to our website, pmi.co.uk, where you can listen to all of our leadership podcasts. You can also watch our Room for Improvement videos and join our monthly PMI Live webinars. Of course, if you'd like to know anything more about developing your own career in business excellence and transforming your organisation, please do drop me a line, team@pmi.co.uk. I'd love to hear from you. I look forward to it.